The Bloomberg Tower was completed in 2005. The New York Times Tower was completed in 2007. In their planning stages, they were each depicted in complex renderings available for view online, intended to show how they would fit in with their surroundings. These virtual constructions, designed for marketing purposes, have no real utility in construction, but they can mean everything to big-name architects called Starkitects and newcomers alike. Jeff Mano is senior editor at Dwell magazine. He says that architects are waking up to the fact that if you can post a sexy rendering of some building that may never be made online, you can increase the likelihood that it actually will be made.
Suddenly people are going to want to see that building. They're going to want to see it happen in the way that when you see a preview come up on the internet for a movie that doesn't come out till next summer, you're sort of building up hype. I mean, the rendering software that architects are now using do produce renderings that are almost hypnotic. You could look at buildings that don't exist for hours because they're so beautiful. And there's a lot of software that is actually crisscrossing back and forth between architecture and special effects industries, especially in Hollywood, where the exact same software that people use to model, say, explosions or CGI for the film Iron Man, that same software package is now being used by architecture firms. And so the new public appeal of architecture is almost entirely visual.
And you talk about buildings that don't yet exist. You may also be talking about buildings that can't exist. There's been some controversy over some of these renderings where the trees and the scale and so much of it simply doesn't reflect the kind of environment it's going to be in or could be in. And if you show an aerial rendering, it seems to reduce its imprint on the surrounding environment.
The way I sort of describe it is that they're almost like science fiction stories, that it's a way of presenting the world so that it looks vaguely the same, but there's something not quite right. And that's that you have added a building or an entire complex of buildings or an entire city to the skyline. And so you're dealing with a kind of collective fantasy that you're presenting a view of the world as it may exist. You're not trying to reflect the world as it is. A good analogy, though, is to stick with this film idea, which is that a rendering produced by an architecture firm is very much like the description of a film that a director would give you. I mean, if Steven Spielberg says that, you know, he's just directed the greatest action film of all time with nonstop laughs and it's fun for the whole family, you're not going to just post that onto your blog and say, oh, this is the film coming out from Steven Spielberg. You're going to question that a little bit.
Or when Wolf says that CNN has the best political team on television.
Yeah, that's Wolf's rendering of CNN, as it were. So, I mean, that's really all an architect is doing. They're just presenting literally the best looking image they possibly can of their building. And they're doing it not only as a standalone artwork, but they're doing it as an act of persuasion.
Are there any telltale signs that a rendering is out to manipulate you?
To be honest, I mean, the very act of it being a rendering is sort of inherently out to mislead you in the sense that that's kind of the point. You know, there was a time where producing renderings was almost irrelevant. I found quite frequently that when you get in touch with an architect because you're interested in a certain project that they're doing, that they don't even have renderings of it. They have floor plans or they have sections or they have other forms of project documentation that are actually useful for constructors or useful for the contractor or for developers or for the people that are going to move in. But the rendering as a kind of unified floor-to-ceiling visual image of architecture isn't even something that is necessary in order to grasp a project.
You say that these renderings aren't the best way to penetrate to the truth of an architectural idea. But in the movies, you always have that scene of the master builder standing in front of his, you know, 3D design.
There's the scene in Die Hard where the German terrorists have seized the Nakatomi building in Century City, Los Angeles. And they sit down with the head of the Nakatomi Corporation and they're at a table that's covered in models. Models of all these high-rise buildings that this corporation wants to build all over the world.
And when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Oh, that's beautiful. I always enjoyed to make models when I was a boy. The exactness, the attention to every conceivable detail. It's beautiful.
There's this kind of idea that architects are all sort of power mad and that, you know, urban planners, architects, military generals sort of lurk in a dark room hovering over an architectural model, spying on the city that they want to take over. There are famous photographs of Saddam Hussein pointing down at architecture models of the Baghdad to come that, you know, obviously he never had a chance to build, or of Hitler and his architect Albert Speer looking down at their plans for Germania, which was going to be, you know, Berlin 2.0, this gigantic city of marble statuary and huge capital domes. The model of this kind of future city or future architecture is definitely something that is supposed to bring out the power mad or bring out hubris or ambition in people who gaze upon it.
Jeff, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jeff Mano blogs about architectural conjecture, urban speculation, and landscape futures at BLDG blog, buildingblog.blogspot.com, and is an editor at Dwell Magazine.
Come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.